Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and it's a Sunday evening, but we are back because we had to cover something. I'm joined by my co-host. But what do you call the buddy of police these days, Martin? What's the phrase?
Embedded, isn't it?
No. My partner.
Your partner in crime. We had to come on and do this podcast. This is really important and it's going to affect parents up and down the country. It is affecting them right now. So we had to do this.
Look, the Irish Times has reported that the government is planning to create special education centres as an emergency response to the shortage of appropriate school places for vulnerable children. Now, I wanted to read that sentence because it rings of an old Ireland that we kind of hoped wasn't still following us around. But enough about me. We are delighted to be joined by children's rights solicitor, partner in human rights law firm KOD Lyons, and man who we've had on before and actually should have had on before then again. So Gareth Noble. Gareth, thanks for taking time out on your Sunday evening to talk to us.
Good to talk to you. It's always good to have a distraction from the Liverpool defeat last night.
Yeah. Oh, man, I was sick. But literally sick. But
it was an awful match. Let's be honest about it. It was bloody awful.
The whole evening seems to have been awful, and that we may be talking about what other human rights abuses happened outside the arena as well, because that did not look anyway good. Look, Gareth, before we got sucked down the Liverpool the Liverpool tube, can I ask you for your initial thoughts on the idea that the government are looking at this? How do I put it? Removing children from mainstream education and putting them into these emergency response units. What's your initial thoughts?
Where do I begin? I mean, I've been doing this job for a long time, and I don't think I've had a week where I've been so utterly depressed about educational policy and educational direction. I mean, It's not an exaggeration to say that this policy that's on the table now is just the greatest form of educational apartheid and social apartheid that I've ever seen across any policy front, from any government, from any political party, from any think tank, from any NGO, from any charity. It's utterly depressing. And I say that not as a personal thing, but simply based on the reaction to it from families up and down the country who've been contacting me in their hundreds this week. And the tone of those emails is just one of hurt. It's one of despair. It's one of 100 steps back. And it's actually mind-boggling, to be perfectly honest. Now, on a positive front, it's unconstitutional and it's unlawful and it can and will go nowhere. And at the end of the week, when reflecting on the last week, I actually think it has galvanized people within the human rights community in a way that is really good, because I think such was the change in tone so quickly afterwards that I think the government realized that they had gone not one step, but probably 20 steps too far.
But there was casual cruelty built into this, Gareth. I mean, to announce that you're going to re-institutionalize children out of the mainstream and into what they call special schooling, I mean, that's institutionalization of children who have fought so hard to be in mainstream.
Well, I think we need to be clear about what it was. I think rather than removing children from mainstream, I think actually what it was around reacting to a situation where there were so many children who had no school places. So what we have is we have such a huge over-reliance on home tuition. And home tuition, as we know, is such a poor substitute for a constitutional right to access an education that is suitable and appropriate for you. But also, I mean, there are just so many different layers to this. We've kids who are sitting at home with no placement, no schooling. We have children sitting at home with home tuition, which is always seen as a short-term thing, but of course has been people's reality for a long time. We then have 10,000 children sitting without any assessment of their need at all in circumstances where the High Court recently struck down the HSE's policy on assessing children. So we had 10,000 children who were improperly assessed since January 2020. And of course, in order to access appropriate assessment for autistic children, our education system demands that they have such a diagnostic assessment done. Mm. And so we have that cohort of kids. We then have children who are really struggling in mainstream schools because they don't have sufficient special needs assistance support. The schools don't have sufficient scaffolding and expertise in the area of OT, speech and language therapists, psychologists on site, behavioural therapists, and so on. And so you have children then shoehorned and drowning in those mainstream schools without any adequate support at all. And then you have children who should be in what are called autism classes, which are attached to mainstream schools and which in many instances represent a good idea, because it's about trying to get the early intervention in so that they can share many of the experiences that they have with children in mainstream environments, but have the other benefits of an all-inclusive environment. And also those classes have six children in one class rather than drowning in a class of 31 or 32 kids. So at every layer of the system, it's broken. And the Department of Education for far too long has just simply stepped off the pitch of play and have not both ensured and supported the access to education of a very significant cohort of kids.
And even at that, if you're getting access to it, you may be in an inappropriate level of education because you're still waiting an assessment that means that your needs will not be actually met.
Yes.
And again, Gareth, you know this. Your children only get one chance at this education. You know, I mean, I spent Friday down with the, and Thursday down with the Cork Life Centre and the work they do in alternative education for people who our system refers to as early school leavers.
Yes.
Wonderful kids, full of life and absolutely amazing, but seem to be outside of the norm. And, you know, it really opened my eyes seeing these children just come to life.
An advocate in the whole area said to me something, and I know I've been on your show before and I was talking about my experiences with the residential redress board and all of that horrible legacy. And somebody recently said to me, and it was a really good point, we have a history in Ireland of locking children away and now we're locking them out. And what they meant by that was we are locking them out of proper access to their basic rights, whether it's assessments, whether it's interventions, whether it's schooling now. And you see, the start, middle and end of all of this, and I've been saying this all week, is that the government doesn't have a discretion. Our state doesn't have a discretion in providing children with a suitable and appropriate education. It is absolutely constitutionally mandated. And it is the greatest con trick on families and children across Ireland to say, well, we will set up these autism centres and that will do the job. Because it will not do the job. It shouldn't be a short-term, medium-term, or long-term solution. And the big fear of a lot of families, just like the direct provision system, just like a whole load of other projects in this country, what's short-term is never short-term. We don't do short-term in Ireland. I could be on your program in 10 years' time, and we'd still be talking about how do we close these autism centres. And so that's the reality of the situation, and that is why it needs to be stopped in its tracks.
And you were on the radio. I was listening to you on the radio during the week, and you were saying just this, that it is unconstitutional to do this. But it was first that the kite was flown by Minister Josepha Madigan in a tweet without consultation with that horrible word she uses, stakeholders, because we're all stakeholders in this. No matter who you are in Ireland, you're a stakeholder. So to think that there are only a select group of stakeholders, no, there's a huge amount. But the minister then went on to say that the way it was proposed wasn't her preferred way to do it, but it was actually the minister that flew this kite herself. It was nobody else who flew the kite. There seems to be a very casually cruel attitude to the needs of both the teachers and the parents. Is that what you find really worrying about this, Gareth?
Well, the first I heard of this was from the minister's own Twitter account. That's the reality of the situation. The other reality of the situation is that it caused untold stress to parents who are out there and who are desperately seeking educational placements for their children. Not only is it so dysfunctional within the Department of Education, but their allies in the National Council for Special Education are even further in the mire in all of this, because they have had this data. They have these figures. And why have we only used, for example, that Section 37A process twice since 2017? That's where you compel schools or support and or compel schools to provide proper support for children. That, of course, was opposed.
Sorry, we've only used it twice.
Yes.
Okay, I just want to repeat that for listeners. Think about that in terms of the numbers of children.
The direction on schools and a plan from the National Council for Special Education to actually set up, that has actually only been invoked twice. Now, we know the numbers. Children's births are registered in Ireland. They all get PPS numbers. It is, from my perspective, has to be the simplest task in the land to be able to understand how many children are going to be coming through the system at any particular time.
But the Tánaiste to say that they couldn't predict, and the Tánaiste did say that they could not predict the numbers they would need based on the numbers that have gone through the system. Now, it seems absolutely obvious that that's the way to do it, but he was never asked to explain why couldn't you predict.
Well, I'll tell you why he can't safely predict, because the HSE's assessment of need process under the Disability Act is itself on its knees. 10,000 children, as I say, who've been improperly assessed, and a failure to provide them with an early intervention assessment, which signposts the way for them to be able to have their constitutional rights protected and vindicated. So that has had the domino effect in relation to seeping into the educational system. But let me put it a different way. We were all very exercised today, and if you turned on your radios or your social media pages today, a lot of people very exercised by the queues at Dublin Airport, which seem to go around various corners and as far as the eye can see, right?
I passed it coming up the M8 from Cork, but go on.
Yeah. So that seems to have exercised an awful lot of people today, right? But the families and children that I work with, they're all in queues, except those queues are invisible. Those queues go round and round and round, and it's not 40 minutes or 2 hours or a day to get through in that scenario. These are years that they're in those invisible queues, whether it's an invisible queue for an educational assessment, whether it's an invisible queue to enable a child to talk. That is the blunt reality of the situation.
They're not just missing a 2-week holiday, Gareth. They're missing a lifetime.
Can I ask an actual question? And maybe this is unfair of me, but I know of so many of those. Like we've seen the equivalent of, say, when we always say with the Nordic countries and how they assess them, and how early childhood education then can be actually tailored to the child's needs, and then they will be automatically almost part of mainstream education going forward because it's done, assessed early and moved early. We had Dan Norstrup on from Finland, from Helsinki, talking about how the difference from when him and his wife moved over. Martin, you know this story, and how it literally opened his eyes to how things were so much different. But we also talk on this podcast a lot about ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, and we're almost building them in. I know they're life limiting things that we store up. And if you can, as you say, Gareth, exclude children from the education system, they are adverse childhood experiences that we'll be paying for years to come. I'm just a bit sensitive because of the weekend and haven't seen everybody in the Cork Life Centre, but this just seems to me to scream that more needs to be made of this, because we can't have a situation whereby a minister flies a kite, then they seem to scurry behind to try and put some meat on those bones, and then everybody's running around feeling rightly so, a judge to say, well, what the hell is going on here? Why are the children being discussed in this topic? And why are they the subject of a Twitter thread that got out of control?
I mean, that's such a good point. I can't answer the question. I can't explain or pretend to know what are in the minds of those who make these calls and make these decisions. But I mean, if we go back to the National Council for Special Education and the department, as we sit here tonight, there are thousands of special needs assistants up and down this country who are in many respects the unsung heroes of our education system, because they enable children to access the curriculum and cater for their care needs within school. All of those special needs assistants are sitting there tonight not knowing whether they have a job in September, because the department and the NCSE, notwithstanding everyone begging them to identify the resources for each school, still won't publish those details. Now, how on earth can a board of management or a school principal or teachers or any educators plan properly, suitably and appropriately when that is the case? I mean, it's beyond negligent at this stage in terms of that type of approach. I mean, with the National Council for Special Education, they throw schools under the bus, left, right and centre, instead of ensuring that they have suitable and adequate supports. And it is turning schools off providing proper access and support. And therefore, we are also finding huge tension then, therefore, in certain circumstances between parents and schools, because they're in a scenario where they are of the view that the school who is not being supported or in some instances being strong-armed into ensuring that every school provides that level of access. So parents are getting it really, or from a parent's perception, they are seeing doors being shut wherever they look. And we need to, in some respects, just go back to basics. And the basic really is, this is a constitutional right. It's not a privilege. It's not something that is something that, you know, the crumbs off the table and that will do. And yeah. I mean, with the National Council for Special Education, I mean, I wouldn't get them to run the bath for me. Mm-hmm. And that
you've been galvanized by this experience, Gareth, and that the parents you work with have been galvanized. And I presume part of that galvanizing is that the parents and the organizations the parents work with now realize that there is no low bar within government. This government do see children's rights as something that's negotiable, something they can get rid of, something that is theirs to debate over. It's not a subject for debate. We're very clear about this. It is not a subject that needs to be debated. Special centres for autism do not need to be debated at all. It's unconstitutional. So how is this going to galvanise the parents and the organisations that work for them?
Well, I have been doing a little bit of work with a really good organization here in the Dublin 15 area, where there were 22 children without a suitable and appropriate onward placement for September. And they have campaigned in a way that was just a textbook example of how it can and should be done. And they have dragged the political classes to the point where, thankfully, it looks now as if all of those 22 children will be found a suitable and appropriate place. Now, we might, on the one hand, look at that and say, isn't that a fantastic achievement? A community getting together, working hard for shared objectives, great. But I can tell you, not one of those parents ever wanted to be in that scenario. And why on earth do you have to sell your soul, open up your private life, your child's privacy, whether it's in the newspapers, on programmes like your own, on primetime exposés? I mean, to think that you have to go to that length in order to vindicate a basic core constitutional right that actually doesn't just benefit that child, it benefits all of us. And it really galls me to think that actually what we are ultimately saying when we fail to prioritize the rights of the families that I work with, is what they hear is, you don't matter. You're not a priority to us. You're a problem. That's what they are hearing. And it doesn't even need to be said. That is what they are feeling and hearing from those types of responses. And the lack of ambition around these things is actually probably the worst part of it. I mean, you guys were down, as you say, at the Cork Life Centre. Look at the ambition that those people who run the Cork Life Centre have for the young people and the families that they work with. It's all about raising people up, enabling them to be the best that they can be, and really just saying to them, you matter, you have a talent, and we're going to harness that. And if we could replicate Cork Life Centres in every part of Ireland, wouldn't it be great? But we can replicate the spirit that they have. We can replicate the values that they have. And we can replicate the ambition that they have. But it needs to come from the top down as well as from the bottom up.
It absolutely does. And I want to make it clear, like, again, I referenced the Nordics earlier. You know, they talk about, you know, for every early intervention that if a euro you have to spend, you get four back. Right. Oh. Economically, it's just insane not to be doing these. So if you're a bean counter, you're actually costing more money in the long term. And that the bean counters need to sit up and pay attention to that, because there's also people who believe in the waste of taxpayers' money. And that sort of as awful as that sounds, Gareth. And you know, but it's a lose lose when we have that mindset. I suppose if I could frame it again, though. I often think about the interviews I've done with Leilani Farah, the former UN Special Rapporteur for Housing, and she wrote to the Irish government and she warned them what was going to happen with the financialization of housing. I think it was around 2016, 2017, and everything has come to pass, but she got her letter back saying, you know, she was wrong. And she talked about the need for housing as a human right, and said, oh, they said, well, we have that. But she said, but if you can't attest the right, you don't have access to it. And this is very clear here in this case, that we have got this constitutional protection to a minimum standard of education. Plus, I think it was, and Gareth, you'll correct me, I think it was 2011, where they said, you know, there was an even further right to, it was defined as, you know, the full primary education and more on that. And we're not actually, and your needs met, by the way, was the appropriate phrase. I believe in that. So when I think about it on that basis, we don't have real, we can't attest those rights for thousands of families right now tonight.
The right to an education is actually in our 1937 constitution, believe it or not. And then in 1998, the Education Act went further and referred to rights. The 2004 Epson Act, Education for Special Educational Needs, has never been implemented, other than the setting up of the National Council for Special Education and a few other ancillary matters. And I mean, we're in a situation where the law is there. And that's why I actually kind of get quite, I mean, I know that you guys in particular, you know, highlight so well and so often about the lack of rights that we have in the area of what I call the two H's, health and housing, right? I mean, we have much fewer rights, legal rights, in the areas of health and housing than we actually do in education. And yet, here we are with a much greater level of state protection for education rights. And we have all of these examples of children who do not know whether or not they can pack a school bag for September and a lunchbox to go with it. They don't know where they are going. They cannot buy their school uniform along with their friends. Their parents can't plan anything for them because they simply don't know. And here's another and we talk about wasting resources, right? There was a really good group in the Dublin 6 area. An autism community group, and they did a really interesting Freedom of Information request in November of 2021. And in South Dublin alone, this state, for 183 school days a year, is spending close to 12 million euros on transporting kids out of their local communities, past their own schools, past their own friends and neighbours, into far-flung schools to meet their needs. I mean, there has to be, I mean, think of the 12 million euros that could be invested in in resourcing local schools to do that. So what we really need to do from now, and I'm calling really on schools here to join. I know they've joined the debate, but I really think that this whole week has to look at everybody stretching themselves even more in order to come up with a solution. Because for me, it shouldn't be any longer a question of whether a school supports children, autistic children, and children with additional educational needs. It shouldn't be any longer about if they do that. The debate now is about whether, is about how they do that and how they can be supported in doing that. Because we know that in some areas and in some parts of the education sector, there are schools doing a lot of heavy lifting that schools in other areas are not. And I think that has to, that the idea around inclusion and the values around inclusion has to be in every school, whether they are private schools, whether they are public schools, whether they are DESH schools, whether they are educate together schools, and so on. Everyone has to see all of these children as being integral parts of all of our communities, and stop othering in terms of saying, well, and there are most definitely schools out there, and they know who they are because I've written to them often enough, where they where there are what we call soft exclusionary policies, i.e. we're not resourced to deal with your child, or that school down the road, you know, has a sensory room, or that school down the road is better suited to you.
Yeah. So we can it does happen a lot, Gert.
We can have every charity sleep out, a rattling tins once a year, singing Christmas carols on Grafton Street. All of that is good. But what does it tell those students? What does it teach those students? If you're also saying to those students, well, by the way, we're all very privileged, but we won't be catering for autistic children. I mean, we have to really have a proper look and a debate at exclusionary policies within our schools, as well as the government passively turning a blind eye to that. And I think that an awful lot of it is an awful lot of this reluctance to trigger Section 37A is about not upsetting certain elements of our educational community, and that has to stop.
I think doubly so for the government, Garth. I'm still gobsmacked that a minister for special education would think that you could fly a kite saying that we were going to exclude these children. These children are a problem, therefore we're going to come up with a solution that excludes them. How that happened, how a minister can think that she has the right to dismiss these, Tony, it's really important.
No. I need to be very clear on this. The minister in question, the Minister for State, Josepha Madigan, is famously put a newsletter out that said that traveller accommodation was a valuable waste of resources. Now, Gareth referred to the othering. The moment you create an outgroup, you dehumanise. Yeah. And when you dehumanise, you're able to pit one group against the other, and therefore you that's how it's done. So when you say it's, Martin, the reason I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm just saying that this is a standard practice, and the minister in question has previous.
I just think it has to be a red line issue for any government going forward. You do not get to take away the constitutional rights that people have fought so hard for. To even suggest that you can means you're not fit to be in the position you're in. And I think that has to be a red line going forward. It must be.
I don't want to get... All I'd say is Josepha Madigan got promoted after she had a go at travellers' accommodation.
I feel so strongly
I don't mean to be personalising this, but I'm just picking you up on that point, because Gareth is very right. No more othering.
When you think of how difficult it is, and I know so many parents caught in the trap. I mean, it is a trap that you get caught into. And you want the best for your children. And the government is actively working against you to prevent you doing that. And I can understand Gareth's frustration, and I can understand why people now feel mobilized. And I certainly hope that it does mobilize people to say, no, enough is enough. Let's sort out the problems that exist without creating any new ones.
Gareth, I think we will leave it there tonight. We may come back to this. I'm hoping we'll come back to this in the next number of weeks.
And thanks for the work you do on it, Gareth. Without your voice, there'd be so many parents just struggling to have an outlet.
Yeah.
Look, it's actually, we talk about privilege a lot. But if I want to talk about privilege in a positive way, I mean, I'm often awestruck by the people that I meet and the battles that they face, and they come through. I mean, it really is like for a parent in a situation such as this, it is like doing the 110 meter hurdles. You get to the end of it and you look across the athletics track and they're putting out the 110 meter hurdles again. And we are better than this. I mean, Ireland and our people, we are better than this, and we have to be better than this.
I think that's a really good place to leave it for the evening. Look, Gareth Noble, thank you for taking time out. As I said, it's Sunday evening. Really appreciate you taking the time. Difficult night last night as well, I understand. Look, I'm a Liverpool supporter, lifelong Liverpool supporter. It doesn't go over well.
We should really just hit pause and then do like a half hour about the Liverpool match last night.
There's so much more. There's so much more to unpick there, I can tell you. But no, look, we're back tomorrow with John Schwartz on what has happened or what has not happened in the US on
gun
violence. Yeah. And you look, lads, if you know John, he's a brilliant writer with The Intercept. We're very grateful that he continues to do this podcast with these two idiots. Although I do think actually, and this is, yeah, look, we're letting the cat out of the bag now. He plans if Trump gets back in, I think he's gonna
move into your garage.
We're his out, you know. Listen, we'll be back to you tomorrow, and there's more lined up. Oh, I mentioned Lelani Farah, the former UN Special Rapporteur for Housing. She'll be back as well midweek, so be good to talk to Lelani, find out what's going on in Canada, because signs are not good on housing globally currently, and we'll let you know how that's looking as soon as we can. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.